Ashley Mortimer, you have been an inspiration. You have been a guide for many people. And you possibly, as I wrote down here in my notes here, you possibly the most public UK spokesman on paganism these days, because you have quite a front with the Durham Valley Foundation, and as the Centre for Pagan Studies. You appear very regular on The Big Questions, and you always appear to be the person that everyone goes to for an interview. How does it feel to be potentially the public face of paganism in the modern day?
I don't know. I didn't know I was until you just told me. It's true that, you've got to face up to these things. Yeah, I've done quite a lot of media, and I've done quite a lot of press. I think they come back to me. They did initially, and I used to get quite a lot of interview requests, and then never got asked back because I think I gave boring answers or answers that weren't sensational. But I think as time's gone on, I've learned to play a bit with sound bites and things, and I hope and think that I give a reasonably good interview. I'm usually quite smiley and entertaining and quite chatty, and hopefully I've continued to say things in a way that other people in the pagan community feel things should be described or can be described. And it's very hard to represent, you know, a huge sector of a community that's so diverse. So I don't really try and set myself up that way, but I mean, the interview thing has always been the same. It's I'm asked to do it, and I always think, well, is this a good thing for us, for pagans? Is it not? And then there's always the question in the back of the head that says, well, if I don't do it, somebody else might, and somebody else might say something that everybody doesn't like or isn't accurate. And I seem so far to have led a sort of charmed life of hopping from stepping stone to stepping stone, of not making a fool of myself and not making a fool of paganism and the other pagans who are represented by some of the things that people like me say. But I'm certainly not the most famous pagan or the most public pagan. My ego won't let me agree with you there.
Okay, that's fine. So on that note then, so where would you define you are in the universe, as it were? How would you describe yourself? Are you a
right
pagan?
Here.
Are you a witch? Are they the same?
Right,
are they
here.
Mutually exclusive?
Right here. I'm a two-legged creature with a spiritual reality to my existence, making a journey through incarnation in human form in roughly the 21st century Western world. That's where I am. That's where we are. We're sort of running around on the planet being surface chemistry, and I'm still connected to that bigger universe, which is, I think, part of where my paganism, my personal spirituality comes from. That's where I'm at, right here and right now. And that is the moment of change, the moment of everything transforming, standing on the brink of an abyss, standing firmly on Mother Earth, standing with my brothers and sisters in the craft and in the wider group of paganism, and trying really hard to be me and not let those other bits like the lizard brain and the ego and those things that we study in paganism and the craft get hold of me.
It's a really interesting philosophy, how it basically is, here you are, here, right now, this is me, and I'm on a journey with everyone else, and how we interact with each other along the way, and that is our journey. So what do you think is the misconceptions then about, say, paganism in the modern world?
Well, they keep changing. I mean, the same as, you're referring to the press and the interviews. The sort of questions I get asked now when I'm doing interviews are different to what they used to be.
What were they before?
Who've been around a lot longer than I have, who used to get asked even worse questions. John Payne would be one of those people. You know, no one's asked me if I drink blood or sacrifice children or anything, so I've been lucky there. But we seem to have moved to the most common question I get asked is, so is it true you take your clothes off at midsummer and leap through a bonfire naked? And I think in a way that's indicative of the wider public opinion or view of what paganism entails, filtered through the lens of why a journalist might ask a question like that to get a good answer. But that's a lot better than the view that they had, I don't know, 20 years ago or so. So although it's still not accurate, it's still a better position than we were in before.
It almost sounds a bit like tongue in cheek, doesn't it? Do you really take your clothes off and jump through the fire? Do you do what they do in the Wicker Man?
It's far too dangerous to do it with your clothes on.
Well, absolutely. So it's paganism. What do people do these days? How would you describe, if someone says they were a pagan, what would be their typical kind okay, of
so,
view.
So historically, the word pagan is a Roman word, paganus, man of the country, which the Romans, we believe, would have used to slightly derogatorily to describe the yokels and bumpkins that they encountered. What they used it for really was to mean people who are outsiders, people who are not part of the mainstream. And to some extent, that's still how the word is in use today. I mean, okay, perhaps 100 years ago, to call someone pagan would be plainly and definitely derogatory. Now, thanks to, I don't know, thanks to the repeal of the Witchcraft Act, the behaviours of various people within paganism over the last 100 years, it's now seen as something else. It's now seen as an outsider spiritual path, religious path. And these things are now understood by the wider public in a way that they weren't before.
Okay. So is that because paganism now has all the religions and all the different thought forms? Is it because they're now being actually taught in school, or there's now a wider acceptance and knowledge of them?
So we can. It's a very wide and diverse set of beliefs that people who identify themselves as pagan have, and there are some common threads we can pick up: belief in reincarnation, belief in polytheistic multiple gods, animism. These are all themes within pagans, but you know, every time you say, "Oh, you know, pagans are polytheists," then somebody will pop up and go, oh, "I'm not.
No,
I'm a pagan, and I don't believe that." So it really is a broad collection of it's a broad umbrella term for a wide collection of spiritual beliefs and religious practices that are outside of the mainstream so-called Abrahamic or book religions. That's and faiths. So I mean, I think that's. You know, you've kind of twisted me into defining paganism again, and that's what it is now, and that's what it always is. Although the way that pagans within the pagan community perceive themselves and present themselves, well, that keeps changing as well.
It does, yeah. I've been following paganism, I guess, from a very anthropological standpoint, in a way. You know, I've got my feet in there, but I don't dive in, as it were. But I do find a greater connection to people who identify themselves through a spiritual practice of paganism. Although I would say I feel very atheistic, but actually I feel very pagan, because I personally identify with the observations that people who are pagan make. You know, they observe the stars, they observe the motions of the earth, the nature, connection to nature, and the things that we can all see. I find that to be very connectivity, and I find that in unison with those people. Although I would not say I have a belief in gods and
faith.
That way. So it's a very
that link of faith, isn't it? That's that extra little bit, that thing that says, look, I'm observing all these phenomena, and it makes sense. I mean, personally, I think that if your IQ is a bit bigger than your shoe size, you will realize that existence and reality in life is a bit more to it than lumps of meat with chemicals and electricity whizzing around. Now, I don't mean to be derogatory to people who are completely atheistic, who are so atheistic that they don't believe there's anything more to existence than literally that. But, I mean, it seems to me, and most people I've met in my life seem to say that they think there's something else going on. There's a world of force behind this world of form. There's something else to us that's a non-physical part of our existence, whether it just be brain matter, brain waves, chemicals, or whatever else. There's something else going on. And that's the key. What do you do with that belief or understanding? And for many pagans, and I think that's what makes them pagan as opposed to just animists, is it's that leap of faith to seeing that there's something else involved, an external force or power, which we might call the divine, gods, goddesses, whatever, but divinity in nature, something divine. And because it's divine, then it's a question of what the human reaction to how we respond to that is. Do we worship it? Do we get down on our knees? Do we have a Gnostic experience with it? Do we see it within ourselves? Do we revere the divine within nature, or which most pagans do, actually, I should say. But it's an exploration and it's a journey. And I started off by saying that, you know, my personal journey is the same principle as many other pagans' personal journeys. And it's about answering that first question that you asked.
Yes.
Where am I? Where am I going? Where have I come from? In fact, the simpler the questions, the more difficult they are to answer. And I think the more profound the answers will be when we find them.
Yeah. I would, and that certainly feels like a interesting description of what it all is kind of summed up into something quite nice. So what are the misconceptions then that, say, the outsiders have of people who are pagan? Is it that they are, I guess, you mentioned we child sacrifice, we throw people in fire. Has that ever actually happened, or is that just what people did along the time and we blamed them for that, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think historically there's... there's a case of bad press. There were political movements in play from, well, from human history. It's human nature, but the coming of currency, the coming of technology, the coming of money, wealth, power, and civilization, I suppose, the advance in civilization, meant that human beings went up against each other or were trying to gain an advantage. From a religious point of view, I think in this country it started probably, well, it had started already, but it's the Norman conquest, and it's the Normans bringing of their culture to our islands to impose upon us their culture, which included their religion, which was Christianity.
Yeah.
And I think that there were organisations, you know, I mean, people say the church. Well, there was lots of churches. There was lots of different factors and sections within there.
Of course, yeah.
But that idea of pushing people around by telling them what to believe, very potent and very powerful and a very good way of controlling people. And of course, if you're going to create outsiders, and as I say, the word pagan and the word witch in some cultures has that meaning of being somebody who's an outsider, somebody outcast, somebody who's different to us. You set up the difference and then kind of demonize it, basically. And yeah, that's what happened. And that's where some of these misconceptions arose. And that's where some of these ideas came from. You know, that our pagan ancestors were running around pursuing their spiritual and religious path by taking lives and murdering and pillaging and so on. I mean, I don't doubt that there were people who had very strong religious and spiritual beliefs that were not part of the norm who did that. There were plenty of people who were in the mainstream religions who did exactly that, who conquered and wielded the swords for power of and in the glorious name of whichever divine presence they wanted to invoke. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's a reflection of the reality of that. So, yes, people who were outside of the mainstream faiths and religions and beliefs, the so-called occultists, I suppose, were studying more subtle interpretations of reality. And in order to do that, you have to prod the boundaries a bit. But, you know, I don't think that there's ever been a mass hidden, secret, underground society that performs... you know, human sacrifice on that sort of level, and certainly not, you know, in any sense in modern times. I mean, you know, prehistorically, there's evidence that grave burials from even as late as the turning of the millennium, first millennium, that people were buried in graves in some kind of quasi religious or quasi ritualistic manner, but. You know, the kind of practices of occultists and pagans for the last few centuries have no real bearing on that, no real bearing on the idea of blood sacrifice or hurting somebody else. In fact, most modern pagan paths have a moral and ethical tenet behind them, same as other religions.
And they do, yeah.
Generally speaking, it's the same tenet. Don't hurt people and stop being a dickhead. Am I allowed to say that?
Of course you can, of course you can. That perhaps should be the moral of every group of people, you know. Be moral, don't be a dickhead. Yeah, actually, I have to say, that's perhaps a method and a message to live by, really, isn't it? You know, don't be a dick.
Yeah, but just be careful, because, you know, the last guy who went around saying that 2,000 years ago got nails strung up for it, and they really did make a mess of him, and a lot of dickheadery was perpetrated in his name. So, you know, and again, I think that's just human nature. That's not something that you can hold against it, but... That's the point, I think, of most religious paths. There's not very many religions that would say, oh, yeah, we are out and out deliberately harmful to others and bad and not very nice. It doesn't, you know, those kind of forces are not forces to harness. The force of good, whatever we define that as and however we use that, is something that's central to most religions. And,
yeah,
you know, I mean, maybe you could sum most religious doctrines up with, you know, be nice to each other and don't be a dickhead.
There seems to be quite a strong, like, European flavour, isn't there? A Northern European flavour to paganism. And there's certainly the ones that I've experienced and the people I've spoke to. There appears to be a blend of traditions, both oral, practical, that has perhaps survived from the Nordic and Germanic and times that have come through and filtered through. Like you said, messages, you know, from those ancient times have kind of filtered through, and people have continued doing those natural practices, either within their family units or generational teaching. And that has survived. So when I... Sonny, my journey of discovery into the world of paganism, I kind of came across the works of Gerald Gardner. I came across the works of Dawn Valiente. Of course, you're very deep in with the Dawn Valiente Foundation. And I was surprised to see that paganism actually is quite relatively new in terms of its current form. Only really around like the late 1800s to early 1900s, that appears to be when it was rediscovered, or perhaps was discovered, but perhaps in older clothing, should we say. I mean, how do you view that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, modern religions like Wicca, which is the best way of describing a religion founded by Gerald Gardner, it really is a modern pagan religion with ancient roots. But then I suppose if you pull apart any other religion, if you're interested in religious history or human beings' religious development, you're going to find ancient roots at the heart of everything. There's no doubt that our ancestors did fantastic and interesting things in what we describe sometimes a bit blithely as uncivilized or savage cultures. The understanding of reality in simpler times and in simpler parts was high. There's no question that our ancestors knew stuff about the way the universe works, that we look at it from a scientific point of view now, and the mind boggles that they understood things in that way and yet could be so far off understanding other things in other ways. But yes, the Gerald Gardner story is about the 1950s, and really what Gerald's doing is he's an occultist, I think. He's a folklorist and an occultist, and he's building a system of working occult magic in order to make connection and communion with higher, I'm going to say higher, but that's a relative term, entities that are non-physical, so let's say the divine. And he built and created a system that's based on occult principles that had been around for several centuries. And he did really pull stuff together. People say he made it all up. Well, he didn't make it up. He just took bits from other things and built this system called Wicca, which is a sort of like other systems like that. It's an iceberg. The very tip of it is showing. The very tip of the iceberg is above the water, and that's the rituals and the written bits of what Gardner did. But I mean, as you hinted, I do know quite a bit about Gerald Gardner and the things that he told people who were around with him and who studied with him. And he wasn't an idiot. He knew what he was talking about magically. And I think that one of the measures of religious systems, or at least magical systems, pagan systems, is whether they have any longevity. And when they do, the inference is that they're working, that they do work. I mean, I would say craft works, because I've done craft. I know how it is. I know how it works. And I want to understand more about how it works, but it does. And people find this satisfaction in that. People find that resolution within themselves, that understanding of the journey through life, through the eyes of somebody who can see existence in a different way that makes sense to them. And, that works for me, so that's what I do. And I know quite a lot of other people who feel the same way.
Yeah, so, the one difference I find, and I think it's the reason I enjoy talking to you, is that you have a very a different vernacular to many pagans who I've spoke to. And
I do.
You do, very much so. In a way that
well,
you...
Well, maybe I'm not so representative of the rest of this then.
In the sense that your vocabulary is much larger when it comes to your understanding. You've clearly have studied this through life experience and your time with the craft, and you have developed a vernacular and a vocabulary of lots of different understandings. And you've got, okay, I know kind of where I am with a lot of people. Perhaps it's because they're not sure where they are and they're not sure what to say. So they're trying lots of different things in order to formulate their idea to come together, as yours appears to be much further along that line to when you're describing your experience.
Danger, Will Robinson. Yeah, once you start thinking you know something, then, you know, upstairs seems to me to have a habit of dropping on you sometimes quite sudden understanding that you don't know so much as you thought. Which, to me, is part of the beauty, bliss, joy, and ecstasy of living. But you're right. Maybe I do talk about things, but the answer is that things are simple.
Yeah.
Really, life is quite simple. You know, and if you look at religious systems, the religious systems themselves are simple. Wicca is really simple, actually. Most of us who do it throw human complications in, but it's a cycle of life, death, rebirth.
Yeah, I get that.
You know, with a bit of love and kindness for other human beings, compassion, wisdom and understanding thrown in there. And it's funny enough, I was asked by my high priestess in Dundee, who, a lady who I respect enormously, who's taught me so many things, the most important of which is trying to be happy, learning to laugh. And she said, can you just be succinct, Ashley, and tell me, now you're a high priest of the craft, what you think witchcraft is? And I said, well, my understanding and experience now, it's totally different to what it used to be. It's living, it's going through life with the ability to look at what's happening to me and my relationship with the wider world through a lens of something approaching, an attempt to understand it. That's what it is. Witchcraft is trying to understand. And she's got this great way of putting it. She said, you got your hat on? And I said, what do you mean? And she'll say, your invisible pointy hat that lives inside your head, because you're a witch now, and that's how you look at the world, and you change your perspective. And so there's a secret of Wicca that we all, or most of us, wear little invisible pointy black hats in our head, because we can't take them off. Once you've seen something, you can't remove that.
No, I guess you can't. So the Centre for Pagan Studies, then. So how did so which came first, actually? Was the Centre for Pagan Studies, which you're the director of, did that come along first, or did the Doran Valiente Foundation come first?
No, the Centre for Pagan Studies was founded by John Bellen Payne and his wife Julie,
okay.
Who had been, they'd been on a weekend course on something vaguely New Age that they thought was bogus. Or John had been initiated into the craft quite some time ago, and he'd been on this weekend course, and they'd had a nice dinner, and they paid for a hotel, and somebody had painted some runes on some stones, and they'd all picked them off the beach and gone away, and, you know, 400 quid lighter. And John thought, hang on a minute, there are people out there who are looking for this understanding behind the world. Maybe they're not all suitable for witchcraft or paganism or Wicca, but there are subjects that we could do, and they happen to have a decent-sized property in which they started putting on talks by various people, themselves included, John included, gave several talks on similar subjects. And the premise of the Centre for Pagan Studies was to educate people or help people to find their own education without it costing them a lot of money and without someone profiteering out of it. And it just so happened, which... again, my high priestess in Dundee says if she ever writes her autobiography, she's going to call it. It just so happens, a funny thing happened on the way to, you know, living and dying. It just so happened that Doran Valiente, who lived in Brighton and nearby, took an interest, came to one of the talks, liked what was going on and the premise of what they were trying to do, and wanted to get involved. And she and John became friends, and then they did some magical stuff together as well. And after Doreen passed on and she left her legacy to John, he decided to form the Doran Valiente Foundation, to which he donated the entirety of the collection of magical books, papers, documents and artifacts that Doreen and himself, with Doreen together, had amassed. And the Doran Valiente Foundation was born. So the simple answer is Centre for Pagan Studies first, Doran Valiente Foundation second. Doran Valiente Foundation's goal is to protect and preserve and collect artifacts and documents and learning and information and start to propagate it. And the Centre for Pagan Studies is one of those mechanisms by which we can help to share the knowledge that's within that collection for those who want to seek it and to the wider public as well.
Oh, I understand now, thank you. So Centre for Pagan Studies, I mean, are you doing talks yourself on a regular basis through that avenue?
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of talks, actually. I do a lot of talking, funnily enough. I perhaps need to shut up a bit, really, but until upstairs tell me to shut up, then, I mean, if they said, be quiet, Ashley, then I will. But yeah, I'm out and about giving talks under the banner and name of the Centre for Pagan Studies and the Doran Valiente Foundation, and it depends on the group that I'm talking to. I mean, I've done, as you say, media and press, but mostly pagan conferences and pagan events, but then there's things like Pagan Pride, where that touches the wider public a bit. And I've done talks and lectures at the British Paranormal Association and various other interested fields that are interested in paganism. And I've got involved in some faith groups as well, some interfaith and multi-faith groups. There's a few meetings of other faith groups that go on behind closed doors. I get invited to a few of those to sometimes give a presentation. I'm doing one in Nottingham in a few weeks that's on the subject of exorcism. And there'll be people from various faith groups and people from some other organisations relating to mental health and that sort of thing who will be getting together to do a seminar. So I don't think I'm actually presenting at that one. But those sort of interfaces with the rest of the world, I'm doing quite a lot of those.
And, no, that's just
sometimes
good.
With the banner of Centre for Pagan Studies and Doran Valiente, sometimes just because I don't know, maybe I come up in Google or something as biggest idiot or loudest mouth or something.
No, it's quite, you talk about the subject of exorcism there. It's quite an interesting one because, of course, everyone has a, within the respective faith, they have their own view of what is causing that effect. And so it may have possibly been, as that religion was formulating its ideas and trying to write its scribe down and trying to understand and develop the world, they were seeing people who had issues, whether they be mental, whether they be spiritual or physical, happening to them, and they decided to write it into their scripture, into their understanding, whether it be oral and physical traditions. It's become part of their faiths, whether it be Christianity or Islam or the Sikh. And it's very interesting to understand how paganism sees that, because I guess if it, as it has existed from time immemorial, trying to understand the world, that would have been seen with people who have epileptic fits or people who are having mental health issues or having those kind of experiences happen, whether they are paranormal, whether there's an external force acting upon that person, to have, like you said, an interfaith discussion about how that is seen by different people is really quite powerful. That's really good to know that that's actually occurring.
That's very important. I mean, you know, there's I've done a little bit of chaplaincy work in some mental health institutions, and of course pagans in prison, and pagans, particularly pagans under mental health care and section, it's very difficult, well, I suppose from any religion, you know, because you've got an invisible friend in the sky and he's kind of the all-powerful being and he's told you you're special. Well, where do we draw that blurred, there's a blurred line between a mental health issue,
exactly,
delusional, yeah, thinking that's an aberration of the brain, whether that be diseased or whatever you want to talk about, and an actual genuine Gnostic spiritual experience. And it's that interface of where spirituality meets mentality. And if you look at I'm diversifying the conversation now, but if you look at the underlying occult systems that built things like Wicca and other magical practices in the modern age, then you'll see that there are ways of understanding division between body, mind and spirit.
Absolutely.
And that the study of that is really, that's exactly what informs us as to how to handle within our society people who are talking about meeting the fairies and encountering the elves or whatever other descriptions they want to give. I know I've been frivolous with that terminology and that language and vernacular. So, you know, determining whether somebody has mental health issues that can be treated, and possibly even, I'm going to use the word cured, the C word, but, you know, as opposed to somebody who's having a genuine mystical experience, you need people who have got mystical knowledge or who have had mystical experiences themselves to be able to help you. And interestingly, when I first started doing some chaplaincy work, in fact, in the several times I've done these things, I've spent more time talking to the staff than I have talking to the patient or the client, because it's the staff who need to know that when someone says, I'm hearing voices, whether they're experiencing schizophrenia, some kind of mental distortion, or whether they're actually genuinely having a spiritual experience. And, you know, sometimes it's quite hard to tell the difference. I often think I'm crazy.
So I was going to say about, it's good to know that that's actually the case. Because when you mentioned about pagans in prison, pagans in hospitals, etc., is there actually much call for people to go in there and actually talk to them about their experiences? Because I've got some friends, you and I share, Farouk, in regards to, he talks to people who of the Islamic faith who go to hospitals and so on, and they have someone to talk to. And it's I'm very unaware of any pagan effort in that regard, who actually goes like chaplains and to go to hospitals. Is that dealt with by the Pagan Federation?
I mean, I don't know. I couldn't give you statistics. I wouldn't like to quote it, but, you know, I've got colleagues in the Pagan Federation who organise such things and interface with the government on such levels. So,
okay,
you know, I think if there was, you'd be hard pressed to not be able to contact somebody who'd be willing to visit you as a pagan if you were in either hospital or prison. And that does vary from bits of the country to bits of the country.
Yeah, I guess, of course, yeah.
And a lot of that depends upon who's in charge of chaplaincy services in that particular health authorities establishment. Although, again, this wider discussion, understanding, interface between interfaith groups is what helps and informs that. So, I mean, although it's probably true to say that the most prominent faith represented by those in charge of chaplaincy services in prisons or hospitals is Christianity, most of those Christian chaplaincy managers are in very good communication with those of other faiths, including pagan faiths, and are therefore able to call upon their help and advice with some surety of, some sense that they're going to get somebody who's going to make sense to come and provide those chaplaincy services, which is so vital in cases like mental health issues and of course people in hospital dealing with the issues of being a human being, which is where their religion and their faith comes in. So, you know, dying, being born, and all bits in between.
So when I think about like the crossovers, and you talk a lot about religious plurality there, I guess a person who comes to mind there is Jay Lacani. Of course, you've had quite a lot of a discussion with.
He's
a
guy.
I love listening to what that guy has to say. He's a really interesting character. And of course, so you guys met on the Big Questions, right?
We did. Yeah, we did. I went, you know, bright and eyed and young and bushy tailed my first big TV appearance and said to the producer, you know, what's your viewership? How many people will it? He went, oh, about 4 or 5 million. And I'm like, you know, don't say the wrong thing, actually. And as I'm standing in this, you know, this sports hall thing, which is where they were doing it, and having a cup of tea, I'm approached by this little chap, and he's small. Jay Lacani's not very tall, and he came up with this smile. And the only way I can describe his presence, he's a person with grace, and I mean that in he's graceful in his movements and his actions, but he's got grace, which is I know you're going to say, oh God, that's a very Christian idea. And he came up and he said, I'm so glad that you're here. And I said, but how do you know me? And he said, well, I've heard a little bit about you, but I know more. I'm so glad that there's a pagan. I wanted to help the BBC to get a pagan on this programme. And he said, I'm so glad you're here, and because you're not represented, and there is a part of society that is not being represented in these debates. And he said, I do hope that we can, help the BBC to make their faith programmes and their faith offerings, which the Big Question essentially is. It's morality.
He says, yes.
You know, it was supposed to be. Until they haven't. Although we did both agree that it was a somewhat frivolous debate on are many gods better than one god? You know, because we could have gone around the room and gone, no, no, yes, yes, no, no. Instead of which, it was a fascinating experience. And, you know, and Jay and I were kind of, I don't know, we were having a bit of a, we were winking at each other across the studio and things. I don't think that ever got picked up on camera, hopefully. But we did both side up, because the Hindu point of view is similar to pagan. And Jay's point of view is that religion, belief, faith, and these ideas are pluralistic, that there's room for everybody to have multiple opinions that maybe don't, you know, that don't sit in harmony with each other, and that possibly things are going on a pluralistic level, that it's possible for there to be many gods and one god all at once. Who's got the monopoly on reality? And then we're into some very interesting conversations about how human beings see the world and how they see each other within it.
Absolutely. I mean, religious plurality seems to be, it's a way to make sense of many gods and one god, whether it be, simultaneously holding both viewpoints simultaneously, which we do that all the time. We can watch a movie and we know it's a movie while understanding it. Actually, it's very real because the actors were there, the producers were there, but the semblance it gives, of course, is a continuing like a movie. So you can have the dual narrative point of holding, well, I know it's a fake environment and I know that no one there really got hurt, but actually it looks like it did, and I can enjoy it for that. You can hold both positions simultaneously and enjoy it.
That's right, you know, and that's a suspension of disbelief in order to enjoy the movie. And I know that sounds like a slightly frivolous way of describing it. I mean, spirituality and religion are not entertainment, although they are entertaining, or can be, especially when you're watching other people doing it. The point about plurality or pluralism, the idea that multiple things can be right, even if they seem contradictory, to me, that's a really important antidote to the real bane of belief systems amongst human beings, which is fundamentalism.
Yeah, it's this way or no way.
That pluralistic approach is exactly the antidote that's required in order for the human race as a whole to do something developmental instead of just tearing each other apart because your invisible friend's bigger than mine.
Yeah, you wear a different coloured hat than one I do, so therefore, bang, or for whatever reason. It does seem a bit, you know, humans as such, have a profound wonder about the world, wonder about the universe, and they're asking questions about themselves and their position within it. And if on a one-to-one basis, regardless of what this person's viewpoint is in front of you, you'll often find that they've often wondered, was there someone up there looking after me? Is my grandfather up there or down there? And they want to talk about that on a one-to-one
you're
basis.
Looking after you. It's you. It's yeah, you're looking it's, after you. So, you know, there are those that say it's all within the one. It's a microcosm, macrocosm, and within the one place is all the other things are contained within it. And outside of that, everything contains the one as well. You know, there are people who think of a subjective universe. There's all these very interesting philosophical, logical points of view that can all come together. And I don't see why faith or religion should be kind of exempt from having to be examined scientifically like that if somebody wishes to do so. And I think that the more you throw into this mix of interesting and differing points of view and angles and methods of examining things, the more we're likely to find ways of, you know, basically not annihilating the planet and beating each other up.
Yeah.
Which can only be a good thing for the universe, you know, for the planet and for human beings and for the universe and for the rest of it existence around us.
It does make you wonder, so if we get out there to the universe and we come across a planet that also has the same character gods as ours, are we going to start going, oh, maybe there really was someone?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm laughing, and it makes it look, probably looks on camera like I'm kind of laughing at the notion that there's that there is something out there. But I believe that. I mean, I have made a leap of faith. That's why I'm a person of religion. And to me, Wicca, or the Wicca, is a religious system. But it stops being faith when you have an experience that convinces you that you've had an objective thing that's happened to you. So you meet other people who hold that objective thing, and it's natural to want to get together with them. But that doesn't mean we've got to gang up against the others, or that they've got to gang up against us. And that's why, really, yeah, you've helped me to crystallise today, Christian, that my message is pluralism. Treat everybody's opinion as being valid and okay. You know, apart from dickheads.
Apart from dickheads. That's great. I was wondering what I'm going to name this episode. I've got one now.
Don't be a dickhead.
So I was looking back.
My name is Ashley Mortimer, and I'm a dickhead, or I used to be at least, until a very, very good set of experiences persuaded me not to be. So I'm appealing today to all dickheads out there: repent, repent now.
So I was looking back at the Pagan Pride videos that I recorded from like 2011 to 2020 to now, really. I've filmed kind of every one.
Nine years of Pagan Pride. Yeah.
That's right, 9 years of Pagan Pride, and there was quite interesting characters in the backgrounds and the build up and the extra videos we did around that. And you and I, we got together for a video in 2011, and we recorded it in some woodland not far from here.
In the woods, yeah, I remember in the woods, and I gave you the 30-second version or 1-minute version of witchcraft.
That's right, yeah, I was cutting, and then like the witchcraft in 60 seconds, I believe it was. And you know, you literally nailed it to the point of a second there. And we had a conversation, not this time, but last Pride, so 2017, that you might have got that down to 30 seconds. I was kind of wondering, did you want to put that to the test?
Yeah, witchcraft's looking at the world through a lens of trying to understand it. There you go.
Wow, that's quick.
Okay, that's trite, because that's being philosophical about it. But yeah, you're looking for the bit where we talk about witchcraft, because I know you've got viewers who don't know what it is. So I'm not sure I can nail it to 30 seconds, but I'll try, and let's not play the timer game this time. But
no.
There's four views of witchcraft. There's the two views from inside and two views from out. Within, there's those who believe it's a pre-Christian pagan revival survival. There are those who believe that it's a way of doing magic and nothing more than that, and it doesn't have a religious element. From outside, there's the church view and the lay view, and the church view is that witchcraft is an act of magic performed in conformity with a will other than God. And the lay view is that it's an act that it's the doing of magic for harmful purposes. So there are your four definitions of witchcraft.
Very good. I think you might have hit that under 20 seconds there. Very good. Ignoring the timer, of course. But yeah, so how did you get involved with Pagan Pride, can I ask? Because we met at the Dragon in Nottingham, which is a pub that used to have... It was a very interesting place, because where Spellcrafters used to host its Monday get-togethers, where lots of different people, lots of different ideas came together. I can remember there was quite a few philosophical people. There was quite a few people not of different faiths. There was quite a few people from the Philosophical Society would come there. And there was an interesting melting point of lots of different points of discussion, which is the reason why I started coming in the first place, which is, of course, where I met you, where I met Esme, and that Pagan Pride then took off as a bit of a coalescence of some of those people's ideas. Is that where you came into the whole fold? Was that?
Sort of. The pagan scene is full of things called moots. A moot is an old word meaning a get-together, a gathering, and a discussion about things. And so that the pagan community in all over the country, in fact, all over the world, holds moots, which are ostensibly a gathering of people who want to talk to each other about different interesting subjects. Now, we're very fortunate in Nottingham that there's a number of different places and different forums where these moots can go ahead. Nottingham Pagan Network, right at the centre and the heart of organising moots, and have been seeding other moots, and there are other people who have come along and started their own moot with a different flavour. Nottingham Pagan Network is still going. The oldest regular meeting of pagan and pagan-related topics in Nottingham is the Empyrean, Nottingham Empyrean, and Nottingham Empyrean holds a monthly meeting in the Theosophical Hall, which they rent, and they put on a speaker on a subject, a lecture, or even a discussion, and sometimes a workshop. And we've had some fascinating things over the years I've seen at Empyrean. That's where I got involved. The Spellcrafters' Moot was started sort of on a friendly basis with Nottingham Pagan Network, and they wanted to do things, and Spellcrafters' view was they wanted to hold open rituals. They wanted to hold a public celebration of the seasonal cycles along a modern pagan theme in Nottingham, and did so and do so. Nottingham Pagan Network was about being a network, was about being at the centre of things, and they still hold a moot fourth Wednesday of the month, Lincolnshire Poacher, Mansfield Road. It's an open public forum, as many pagan moots are. It's it's in the back of a pub or in the pub, and people come, and you know, it's good that they get in touch in advance, but people can sort of show up and look around and go, oh, well, they must be the pagans. And we often run into people who are not pagan. There's a lot of people who are regular attendees of the event, of the moot. So Empyrean can get, I don't know, anything from 20 to 100 people, to depending on who's speaking. NPN, Nottingham Pagan Network moot, gets, I think we've had 150 people packed in the pub for a Christmas or a Yule celebration one year. And usually there's about 20 to 30 people. So these are providing a sort of, this is what Pagan Pride was all about, is sticking up this banner that says there are other pagans out here. And if you want to come and identify as pagan or even just be interested, there are people here who are willing to talk to you and who are not hiding behind closed doors and getting on with it. I mean, it must be said that a lot of the people who attend these events, who are part of the pagan community, myself included, we're getting on with our paganism privately, and that's fine. And you know, but I'm open to talking about what we do and what we think and how we do it, and helping people along their journey. And I don't know, sorry Christian, I've got to a point that's another very important thing, as well as the pluralism, there's something I do want to say, and that is that you reach a stage where you realise, with an objective view, that you've started to accumulate knowledge and experience. And you know, if things have worked out well, and this is the training I've received, is that you then realise that you've got a massive compulsion to start helping other people. I can't even tell you how many people helped me on my journey. I wasn't a clever occultist or a great magician or a brilliant book reader. I was really, really fortunate to be able to be shown how to be humble and ask people for help and questions. And I've been helped on my way. And as you said, I'm now in a position where I can pay some of that back. And really, that's what the point of the moots and the pagan community and Pagan Pride, Nottingham Pagan Network and Empyrean and the Centre for Pagan Studies, Durham Valley Anti Foundation, it's all about. Helping other people to find their way on that path, or on their path, whatever that is, you know. And we've got friends in other faiths, and you mentioned Farouk, and there's people like Matt, who's a lay minister in the Christian Church, who's very well connected to us. In fact, will be taking part in some of the seminars and the other interfaith things that I do with together. And it's about helping people to find their path, and whether that's a Gnostic path or an atheistic path or a full-on faith path. You know, I think probably most of us would, discourage fundamentalism and fundamental behaviour. But helping individuals, and you can do that by sharing your experiences and sharing your knowledge. So for pagans, and for people who think they might be pagan or who just want to find out, come to a moot.
That seems
that's what I did with Empyrean, and I ran into a guy who helped me find my way to witchcraft, and within a few months I was, you know, attending full moon ceremonies in the woods at night.
You know, that's a very it's interesting reflection of a journey that you've had, and something like I feel a kinship with just the other things. You know, you learn, you accumulate knowledge, and you feel a profound feeling and a want to discuss, to talk, and to share, and to give and support other people, because that actually fulfills you in a way that enriches you, but you know that also enriches the person who's with you. And that's a really powerful feeling to have, and it's a really humble feeling to have too.
Yeah, I mean, humility is something that the craft teaches its priests and priestesses, high priests, high priestesses, and that humility, being able to overcome your own ego enough to get hold of yourself enough to be realistic about things. And you know, I mean, I can be a bit self-deprecating sometimes, and I do that mostly to remind myself not to be a big head. You know, don't be a dickhead, the primary directive of what we're talking about here. And that then makes it possible to pass things on, and you have to kind of have an acceptance that you do know stuff and you can show people stuff. So, you know, there you go. There is the great scripture of Ashley's religious path, and what I've got to offer the world is, come and ask me and I'll show you stuff. Because that's what happened to me. And by asking people and approaching people who I thought, you sound like you know what you're talking about, that's fun. And I know you're a little bit that way as well, aren't you, Christopher?
Very much so.
Your nature to find somebody interesting and go, I'll have just a prod and see whether they'll tell me anything.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, not just with paganism either. I guess I have a flavour for the knowledge of the world, and things that I think other people would find interesting is what I choose to share and discuss. If I'm finding it interesting, I'm pretty sure someone else might find it interesting. And I've kind of gone on
that
a bit.
Be different then, I think, because you know, I'm less bothered about whether other people find it interesting than I want to pursue a subject.
Oh no! So what I meant was, if I was to learn something, I think, oh, okay, I think someone else would value from that.
Oh yeah.
So if I was just to share that, whether it be social media, whether it be in a conversation, they might go, I actually find that interesting as well. Then we can have a discussion about it and find out a bit more about it. And I think
the thing is, learning's not cheap.
No.
You know, there's a price to pay, and I don't mean the price of buying a book. I mean that you have to invest a bit in it.
You do.
You have to be willing to work. And I mean, I know that there are paths in certain pagan faiths that appear on the surface to be a little bit facile, but actually it's quite difficult. That journey of understanding of the universe through understanding of yourself requires you, and this is an occult principle that underpins more than just Wicca and witchcraft, it requires you to get over yourself. And that ain't easy.
No, because really your ego wants to pull you back.
It's not something you do once in your life and then you're, you know, you become this thing, this priest, this whatever it is. It doesn't work like that. You know, there's
it's a
constant ongoing test to stop being a dickhead.
Yes, it's a way of life. Don't be a dickhead. And it really is a way of life. You have to live.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because we're all capable of it at any moment. Because when you said, where am I? Right now, I'm standing on the threshold, this here and now, of behaving like a dickhead or saying something stupid or hurting somebody else. And it's very difficult it is difficult. And it doesn't ever stop. Just because you've got some experience that leads you to, you know, to be quite good at not being a dickhead. And you know, then it doesn't mean that you're not in absolute danger of falling into that pit. And, you know, I have to admit, I can be a real dickhead sometimes, and I have been recently, and I probably will be tomorrow as well. Not specifically tomorrow, you know, but...
Yeah, I do understand the philosophy where you're coming from, and the wording you're using, I get that, I really do. Man,
I mean, I like those words. I like that... I like the humour. I like the fact that we can be simplistic about things and maybe a bit humorous about it, because... humor's a nuance to understanding that helps us to get things. You know, if you get a joke, then
the laugh is then on us and on the person. You get it. Yeah. Humor is very it's a powerful method of delivery. Actually, you can sit back and breathe that sigh of relief that you know it was a joke, but then you think back and actually there might have been a message attached to that, and you think about it. It's a really powerful two-way threshold there. And I listen to a lot of Joe Rogan, who of course is a well-travelled comic, and he talks a lot about that. And the fact that if you understand that it's a joke, and there's lots of messages that are shared back and forth between the person who perhaps is delivering the message, the talk, and his experience and his life, or her life, not to be sexist, of course. But now, of course, we're facing a bit of a dilemma in the world of how humour is kind of getting a bit of a knockback. I mean, you find even John Cleese is now leaving the UK because he feels that he can't tell a joke anymore, and Rowan Atkinson has said the same thing very recently in a very powerful speech he read out about how humour, unfortunately, is getting knocked on the head, so you can't express things in a way that we could before. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, no one's curbed my sense of humour yet, but, you know, there's the guy who found the electronic circuitry inside his, I won't say the name of the brand, but inside his modern television that connected to the internet appeared to be, on the surface, voice recognition software, so you could say on television or BBC Two or, you know, whatever channel you want to turn to, and in fact it was sending this information back to the makers of the TV. If somebody was spying on me and heard me in my own home where I am now, with some of the things I say as a sense of black humour or dark humour, then, you know, it'd probably be quite shocking, because privately I'm a big dickhead, you know. So I think that sort of level of censorship, it's about appropriateness of where things can be said, and it's about the effect that it has on other people. So, yeah, I mean, maybe you take the view that the wider society, as John Cleese obviously has, that the wider society is losing its sense of humour and can't get over itself. But at the same time, being able to adapt to being a part of that society is important. And you talked earlier about vernacular. I know you applied it personally to me, but our society-wide vernacular about the way we deal with issues of people's sensibilities and sensitivities and the way that they label each other and label themselves. And I'm talking about things like race, religion, gender identity, and so on. You know, you've got to be sensitive. You have to be sensitive to other people. And it was a lesson John Payne taught me a long while ago. If you don't appear to other people to be reasonable, not being a dickhead, then they're not going to listen to you. And if you want to be listened to, you're going to have to live in that society with that. That said, I think we all roll our eyes. I think most people in society at some point roll their eyes about the way that other members of our society have used blunt tools like legislation and law and other things in order to try and force people to not be dickheads. And, you know, I mean, I suppose while we're pushing that analogy, if it's within you to be a dickhead, you're going to be a dickhead. You can't legislate for that. You can't just make it illegal to use certain words in public or whatever. It requires, and this is the human thing, it requires human beings to wake up and smell the coffee and want to do something to change the way that we live with each other and the way that we live with the natural world around us. And if we don't want to do that, you can't force people. I mean, yeah, okay, I'm not saying I'm against legislation that makes recycling important and charges us 5p for a plastic bag in the supermarket. You know, that's okay, and I think that's right. But really, it's a willingness within human beings, and that comes from being in a society where our societal group, stereotypical archetypal values and ethics and morality changes and moves around. So
yeah, there's a fluidity, like you said, there's a flow. You know, you have to work with, you have to kind of take the tide, come back a bit, pressure out a bit. And I think the very British
kind
of sense of humour.
The dark, unpleasant, filthy joke that I tell you off camera isn't the same as I tell any one of your viewers that can see it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I am, as you know, I'm a person who's kind of comfortable within my own skin and becoming more and more so when I do these interviews and whoever the audience is. But, you know, the sort of thing that I would say to you as an aside remark in the pub isn't the same thing as I'm necessarily going to say on camera. So there's an appropriateness of vernacular language that needs to be used at the right time. You know? But, I mean, I still think I'm a nice guy. I still think I'm a good person who's got a good outlook. And privately at home and within my small groups of friends, I hope that people like me and they don't think I'm a dickhead and that I'm not. But, you know, I think all I'm trying to say is that there's a
meaning, there's
the
a time and
that
place.
You say, it's the context in which they're said that's just as important, and the nuance and so on. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, okay, John Cleese is entitled to clear off elsewhere, and, you know, well, he's gone, he is no more. He has ceased to be a British citizen.
He ceased to be, it's gone. That's great. But Ashley, thank you very much for your time today. I know you said you're heading out this evening. So I wanted to thank you again for your time here today. It's been a wonderful discussion, and hopefully we can do it again soon. I think there's certainly much more room for a lot of discussion. So,
you know, we spend an hour talking about really good stuff, and we always feel, I don't know about you, I always feel we come away just having only scratched the surface.
Yeah, literally just a scratch as well, because there's lots of different places that things can go. So we should arrange sometime in the future to do it before it's too late.
Maybe we could force ourselves to have an agenda, and then you can force me to answer the questions that, you know, whatever, or encourage, you know, people to say what it is they want to talk about. I mean, I hope that these conversations stimulate other people to talk about
absolutely rich
topics.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you open the floor up and you have a discussion, you literally have a one-to-one back and forth, and people go, oh, I want to ask that, because, you know, when you put on the spot, does anybody here have any questions? Everyone has a question, but no one puts their hands up. Only
not on my talks. Well, I don't know. Maybe that's true. No one ever puts their hand up. Does anybody have a question? And then afterwards, you finish the talk and you're packing up your notes and you're thinking, oh, I'm going to get home and have a cup of tea. And there's a queue of people going, just wanted to ask you about this.
Yeah, what's your opinion? You could have shared that publicly, but hey. But maybe that's what people really want. People want that one-to-one conversation rather than a group discussion about their views.
Well, I mean, the way I developed my personal... God, we're back into the interview again, aren't we? I mean, for me, Wicca and witchcraft is taught face-to-face. It's eye contact with somebody who's teaching you and showing you how to find your own journey and your own wisdom. And it's done face-to-face. It's not done through a book. It's not done through a correspondence course. And I've been lucky enough to find people who've been willing to show me and teach me, and I'm lucky enough to be able to pass that on to others. But opening that discourse up and having a dialogue that's two-way, that's really important, yeah.
It is, yeah.
Or multiple ways. Pluralistic dialogue, yeah.
It's something the way I've found.
Anybody, everybody.
Anybody and everybody, that's good. That's the way I think about things too. It's really the way I've kind of re-began this podcast, as A Curious World. It allows me to, you know, open the floor, open the conversation. And if I can find an interest in something, I want to talk to the right people about it. And I find from that, I've got people going to me, oh, I'm so glad you spoke to him, I didn't know about this, and I feel like I'm much more educated from beyond that. And I found that because of that, my audience is growing a bit. I feel I'm growing a lot. I feel the person I'm talking to is enriching as well. So I think it's a multi-purpose, multi-flow benefit for everyone, really. So
no, I think that's fantastic. And I mean, it's, you know, it's a pleasure to come and take up your time and give you things to broadcast about, because I think what you're doing is, you know, that conduit for allowing people with different opinions. And there'll be people you'll have on the podcast who think I'm a dickhead, who don't agree with what I say, or whatever else. And the wider that is, the wider an audience that is, all the better. So.